Accession number 19061, Reel 1.
Mr. Curry, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In Shanghai, China.
Which year was this?
1930.
How long did you spend in Shanghai?
10 years, until we were advised to leave in the early years of the war.
And in what capacity was your father working in Shanghai?
He was working as an engineer. He was the chief engineer of the Shanghai Waterworks Company.
Any memories of Shanghai?
Quite a lot. I've been back twice in the last dozen years and was able to find both the houses we'd lived in and the country club where I used to go swimming. And I recognised quite a lot of the Bund, and I found my father's old office to which I was able to gain access. It's still the offices of the Waterworks Company.
What was life like for a schoolboy in Shanghai in those days?
Very pleasant. I thought it was normal, but I've learned subsequently that it was a somewhat different existence to most of my contemporaries in England at the same time.
What were relations like between the different peoples in Shanghai then?
Well, as I think as a child, one's not particularly aware of things like that, of what's got the sort of undercurrents. Particularly undercurrents with, say, the Japanese. But as far as I know, relationships with the French and the Americans and other Europeans were really very good.
And with the Chinese?
With the Chinese, again, I didn't know any Chinese socially. One had very happy relationship with our servants, and I'm still in touch with the servants who my father employed. I'm still in touch with them now, and I still send Christmas cards to them, and we visited them in 1992.
Were there any conflicts which you witnessed or experienced in your time in Shanghai?
No, when the outbreak of the Sino-Japanese War in August 1937, we were evacuated to Hong Kong, as it was felt it was a safer place and under British protection. And we spent about 7 months there before it was considered safe for women and children to come back to Shanghai.
When war was declared in Europe in 1939, did that have any effect on the community in Shanghai?
There was a reduction in the number of British troops in Shanghai and in the size of the Pacific Fleet, the China Fleet rather. But again, life went on much as before, though clearly adults were a lot more concerned about the way things were going. And it seemed inevitable that eventually the Japanese would come into the war.
So when did your family take the decision finally to leave?
My mother and my brother and sister and I left Shanghai in November 1940 and went to Canada, where we spent much of the war. My father stayed behind and was for a while a prisoner, well, under house arrest with the Japanese, though he was permitted to carry on with his job.
How easy or difficult was it to get out of Shanghai at the end of 1940?
Well, we left in a Canadian Pacific ship, all painted grey, I remember, and lights were shut out at night. We went via Japan to Vancouver, but the ship travelling alone without convoy.
How long were you in Canada for?
Little over 3 years.
41, 42 and 43?
43, yeah. Returning to the UK in January 1944.
And you were in British Columbia all the time?
No, in Ontario, down Toronto, and I was at school down near Niagara Falls.
What was the attitude of the Canadian population towards the war?
Again, as a 12, 13-year-old, I don't suppose terribly aware. They seemed to be generally sympathetic. I was at boarding school in Canada, The Canadians were extremely hospitable and very kind to us because we hadn't a great deal of money, as my father was a prisoner of the Japanese and then latterly in England again.
And in 43 you decided to move from Canada to England?
It was difficult to get passages back across the Atlantic because during 42-43 the U-boat menace was very considerable. My mother returned in early 43 with my youngest brother. I got a passage back on an aircraft carrier in January 1944, and my sister returned in another aircraft carrier in May 1944. So it was some 3.5 years that I hadn't seen my father, and it was something like 4 years when before we were all reunited in the United Kingdom again.
Were there urgent reasons to return during the war rather than waiting until it was all over?
Well, my father had been repatriated. As I said earlier, he was a prisoner of the Japanese, but was one of a number of civilians who had been interned at the beginning of the war. And in November 1942, there was an exchange between Japanese and European civilian nationals. My father was one of those exchanged, so he got back to the UK at that time. The difficulty then was, naturally, the rest of the family wanted to be together with him, but it was difficult to get a passage back. Anyway, we eventually all got back by May 44.
Where did you settle in England?
Originally in Aberdeen, where we were for a year or two, and then we moved down to London, and that was the family's base for the next 20 or so years.
Did the German Air Force's attacks on the country affect you at all?
No, I remember going into air raid shelters. I was at school in Edinburgh after we got back to the UK. I was at school in Edinburgh at boarding school, and certainly there were a number of air raids where we had to go into the shelters. I don't remember any bombing and hearing any bombing. There was an anti-aircraft battery in the grounds of the school, and one's other recollections are mainly of rationing.
How much did that affect you?
Well, food rationing, essentially. As a growing schoolboy, I think one's very much in need of the luxuries of life, like chocolate and so on, which was at quite a premium at that time.
Did you ever go hungry?
No, not really. I think the school food was pretty dire at that time. I think rations were not easy, but I think some schools made a better fist of it than others.
So how did you come to be in the army yourself?
I had considered, during the war, I think one's orientation is towards military service, and it's a matter of which service you decide to go into. I had wanted for some time to go into the army. I had a godfather who was in the Coldstream, and he got me an introduction to the colonel of the regiment at the time. And I suppose it's through that I served with the Coldstream during my national service, which was compulsory at that time, in 1948 when I joined up.
Which month were you called up?
April 1948.
Where did you do the basic training?
I did my basic training, which was 16 weeks, at the Guards Depot at Caterham in Surrey.
What was that like?
Pretty hard work, but the squad of which I was a member were all officer candidates. And therefore, we all had similar sort of boarding school backgrounds, so we're used to some privations. But it was a very pleasant company, and I've remained friends with many of them right up to the present.
Was there anything in the basic training you found difficult to cope with?
No, I don't think. There was a great deal of drill, a great deal of shouting and marching. One obviously got much fitter physically than one had been before, but it was quite an experience, which I look back on with some pleasure and satisfaction 50 years later.
Why pleasure and satisfaction?
It was a remarkable unit of which to have been a member. One had no doubt that one was in a regiment of elite troops. Being a member of a Guards regiment at that time was, I think, even more highly regarded perhaps than it is today, when the military size and importance has been so run down.
And after Caterham?
The next stage in the training process at that time was to go to the officer cadet school at Eaton Hall outside Chester, where we spent another 4 months of so-called officer training before gaining our commissions.
What did the officer training involve?
More emphasis on map reading, man management skills, completion of tasks, generally preparing one to take command, albeit for a relatively short period, of a group of 30 men.
Where is Eaton Hall?
Just outside Chester. It was the Duke of Westminster's estate, and which is now reverted to private ownership.
And is there an A in Eaton or not?
E-A-T-O-N, yes. Eaton Hall. Mm.
What happened to you then?
I was commissioned in November 1948. And after about a month, I was joined a detachment going out to join the 2nd Battalion Coldstream, which at that time was in Malaya. They'd gone out in August 1948.
How much did you know about the situation in Malaya before you went?
Not a great deal. It seemed the most interesting of the locations that the battalions occupied at that time. The Coldstream had three battalions at that time, one in the United Kingdom, one in North Africa, and the 2nd Battalion in Malaya. And there were about four or five of us who thought that Malaya represented the most interesting posting, and we particularly asked if we could go out there, and were very pleased when that wish was granted.
What captured your interest about Malaya?
I suppose it was active service. We didn't seem to be very glamorous to be doing public duties in London, and it was really just garrison duties in North Africa and Tripoli. Malaya seemed to be an active military campaign where one could do some good, one hoped.
Had you done any public duties in London?
No, none at all. I rather regretted now that I never did any at all, but still, one couldn't fit very many experiences into 2 years military service.
What preparations did you have to make for going to Malaya?
Not a great deal. We were issued with some lightweight clothing. Otherwise, it was just a matter of going out and joining the battalion and being instructed in the gentle arts of jungle warfare.
On the voyage out, were you in charge of any men?
No, we were a group of, it was really a reinforcement group of about five of us officers going out to the Coldstream Battalion, plus 20 or 30 men. There were similarly a number of people joining the Scots Guards and Grenadier Battalions who were out there at the same time.
Any experiences to you on the voyage out?
Getting badly sunburned. I don't think we were told quite how dangerous that was. I got quite badly sunburned by going to sleep in the sun in the Red Sea. The whole voyage took about a month, but we stopped at some interesting places like Aden and Colombo and were able to go ashore briefly. We spent Christmas Day was actually in Valletta Harbour in Malta.
And where did you finally arrive?
We arrived in Singapore in the early days of January 1949 and immediately moved up country by train to join the battalion.
What impression did Malaya make on you at first?
Extremely hot.
Was there any danger in the train journey up country?
No, not. I don't think we were. I think we were cautioned in case something should happen, but the chances of the train being attacked seemed fairly low, though it did happen during the campaign. And certainly I witnessed a train that had actually been derailed by the terrorists.
You mean you passed one on the way?
We were sent out to, as a patrol, we were sent out to, you know, to survey the scene while the police and so on did an investigation into what had happened.
How had they derailed that?
I think by pulling up part of the line.
Do you know where that was?
Not offhand, I don't know.
Where did you join the battalion?
The battalion was at, located at outside a small town called Tapa, T-A-P-A-H, in Pira State in Malaya. About 50 miles northeast of Kuala Lumpur.
What kind of accommodation did the battalion have there?
Entirely in tents. There were large white canvas tents. The officers' mess was a wooden structure with a roof of grass. I can't remember the actual structure. The tents were very hot, fairly primitive.
Anything you remember about your reception at Tapa?
Fairly shortly after I arrived, I was told I was not going to be at the main battalion base, but was at where a detached company was, about 15, 20 miles further north, which was detached. And then I was from there sent out to an even more detached platoon guarding a power station.
So what was your job?
I was a platoon commander. I took over in a period of a matter of hours, and the officer who I succeeded went back to battalion headquarters. And I was left with a bunch of 30 men out detached, as I say, guarding the power station and doing patrols from there.
Which platoon and company were you in?
This was number 9 platoon and number 1 company.
And where was the power station?
Place called Malimnawar, Malimnawar.
Did the power station take much guarding?
No, I don't think so. It simply provided a base. We had fairly simple quarters, almost a dormitory in the power station buildings. We obviously had sentries posted at night. And during the day, we would have left a few people behind, but the platoon would have sent out patrols working under the company commander.
Was this an HEP station? Hydroelectric power?
I don't believe so, but it could have been.
Did the enemy attempt to interfere with it at all?
No, not to my recollection.
What can you tell me about the men in your platoon at that time?
They were a friendly bunch. They were, on the whole, older than I was. I was only still 18 when I joined the platoon. They were a mixture of people from the Midlands and from the Northeast, which are traditional recruiting areas for the Coldstream. I was particularly grateful to the platoon sergeant. I mean, many of the sergeants and corporals had actually served in the war and had a great deal more experience of military life than I had. And I was particularly grateful to my platoon sergeant for the way he sort of acted as an uncle to me and showed me what I should be doing.
What do you remember about him?
He came from Liverpool, and I'm actually still in touch with him. It was, I think, an enduring friendship. We got on very well, fortunately.
What was his name?
Les Spedding. He's still alive, not very fit, but he lives up in Liverpool.
Was he a Second World War veteran?
He was, yes. He'd served in the regiment in Italy and I think in North Africa.
What were living conditions like at Malinawa?
I don't think we were there very long. Soon afterwards we went back and we were based at another small town called Kampar, K-A-M-P-A-R. But we were operating in that area, sending out patrols. The military at that time was very much acting, so as we termed it at the time, in aid of the civil power. So we were really doing what the police were anxious we should do, and we did many operations with them. And here again, I think we formed some very enduring friendships with members of the colonial police.
What did you think of the quality or otherwise of the colonial police?
Again, a lot of them were people who'd served in the war. Quite a few had served in the Palestine police in the immediate post-war period.
And you were doing patrol work from Kampar?
Yes, we were doing patrol work there. The companies rotated in a sort of detached position away from the main battalion headquarters, which was at Tapa. We had another company located up in the Cameron Highlands, which had been a well-known holiday resort up in the hills.
How strong were the enemy in the Kampar area?
It was not a particular, what we call a particularly bad area. The number of incidents was not as great as, say, further south where the Scots Guards were located, and we took nothing like the number of casualties that they did.
Can you tell me about the patrol work, what it was like?
The patrols were generally, again, had been agreed between the police and the military command where we should patrol looking for bandit camps, really, and trying to disturb those. The patrols might last a day, they might last, an operation might last a week. I went on certainly one long patrol where we were supplied by air, which lasted between 2 and 3 weeks.
Did you come across the enemy at all?
Only once, where they'd obviously just vacated a camp and one man was left behind and who fired off a few shots at us. But otherwise, though we found a number of camps which we burned, we had no, in my particular platoon, no firefight, shall we say, with an enemy detachment.
Did this man escape?
Yes, I'm afraid he did. The jungle, of course, is extremely thick. It's very difficult to see where anybody is. And if someone lets off a few rounds at you, your natural reaction is to get down and then try and take some action to get round behind him, but it was a very slow progress and I'm afraid he escaped.
What did the enemy camps consist of?
They were very well hidden in the jungle. They were made of wood, a lot of bamboo, raised off the ground. Some of the camps could accommodate 50 to 100 people. We saw quite a lot of them over the period of time that we were there. But as I say, the general thing was to destroy them if we ever saw them, so that they couldn't be used again. We never found any weapons, but occasionally just bits of equipment, bits of uniform, etc.
Any documents or weapons?
Never any weapons. Occasionally documents, yes. I have a piece of with a letterhead on showing that they were the Malayan people's anti-British army or whatever.
In English?
Yes.
How did you destroy the camps?
Just simply by burning them. They were obviously, provided it wasn't raining at the time, everything was really pretty dry, and the sort of wooden construction of the huts that they built was such that if you put a match to them, they burned fairly easily.
What was life like on patrolling the jungle?
I think for a young officer, it was really quite busy. Many of the patrols were at platoon strength, so one was out for the, as I say earlier, out for the day or out for a couple of days, searching an area where perhaps an incident had occurred, like an attack on a rubber estate or a tin mine. Much of it was reacting to something that the bandits had done. Though we did a good deal of patrolling that was just simply looking for where they might be camped.
How did you personally view going out into the jungle for lengths of time?
It was uncomfortable. It was extremely hot. One had to carry quite a lot of equipment if you were going out for more than a day. You generally got very wet. There were leeches and mosquitoes, etc., to contend with. And on one occasion we took flight because the leading member of our patrol came across some tigers.
What was the reaction of the tigers to human beings?
We didn't wait to discover. I'm afraid we beat a very hasty retreat.
What weaponry would you have?
The guardsmen on the hill would carry a sort of lightweight rifles, but we also had a number of Sten guns and at least one Bren gun per section. I myself carried a rifle as the army issue of a revolver was a fairly useless weapon in those conditions.
Grenades?
We'd certainly carry grenades. And, you know, there was quite a lot of ammunition to be carried for the Bren guns, for example.
What orders were given about the use of weapons in the jungle?
I don't remember. When things did happen, they generally happened very quickly, and one hadn't time, I don't think, to consult rules of engagement. But essentially, if you were fired on, you'd have to get yourselves in a position where you could fire back.
Were you ever fired on?
Only on this one occasion when we came upon a camp that was obviously still occupied. But there were a number of ambushes carried out on the battalion and a number of casualties sustained.
Did you ever set ambushes yourself?
Quite often, yes. We were told that a particular route through the jungle was one used by bandit gangs. And several times mounted ambushes to try and catch them, but either they got wind of us or they didn't come that particular day, but I was never involved in a successful ambush of bandits coming into an area we were guarding.
What exactly would you have to do to set up an ambush?
Form a ring around a particular area of track, maybe as it went through, into or out of a rubber estate, perhaps.
Would you be in a ring or in a straight line?
I suppose in an arc along one side of the track. Obviously, if you were on.